is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, and welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Steve Miller, and here's what's coming up.
The latest attack near the village of Gweche follows an upsurge of violence in Cameroon's far north region, including looting and kidnapping.
That's Lisa Schlein in Geneva. We'll have that and more coming up. The United Nations Refugee Agency says victims of suspected Boko Haram terror attack on an IDP camp in Cameroon's far north region remain unprotected and in need of urgent help. At least 18 people were killed and 11 others injured in an attack early Sunday. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The camp, housing 800 internally displaced people, was attacked early Sunday. Militant jihadists reportedly threw a grenade into the compound while people were sleeping. The UN Refugee Agency says it is outraged by this brutal, unprovoked attack and condemns it in the strongest terms. UNHCR spokesman Baba Balach tells VOA that Nigeria-based terror group Boko Haram is suspected of being behind the attack.
In Cameroon, since the early this year, more than 87 attacks have been recorded, which are attributed to Boko Haram. It has affected millions of people in the region, and only in this area of Cameroon, there are more than 320,000 people displaced.
The latest attack near the village of Gweche follows an upsurge of violence in Cameroon's far north region, including looting and kidnapping. Civilians in this area, which covers Chad and northeast Nigeria, have been at the mercy of Boko Haram and other armed groups for years. Balach says the attack on the IDP camp has caused some 1,500 people, including terrified residents of the hosting village, to flee to a nearby town for safety. He says the UNHCR is sending an emergency mission to assess the situation and evaluate the protection and health needs of those affected.
Against the backdrop of growing insecurity, UNHCR anticipates enhanced protection, shelter, water, and sanitation will be needed as the country responds to the COVID-19 pandemic. Access is a huge issue for humanitarians in this region in terms of providing humanitarian support.
The UN says Boko Haram violence in the Lake Chad Basin region has cost the lives of 30,000 people, displaced more than 3 million, and forced nearly 300,000 Nigerians to seek refuge in neighboring countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Morocco tried to mediate between the Libyan warring sides, but got nowhere. Algeria has been talking to Russia to convince General Khalifa Haftar to get involved in a negotiated political solution, but he's placing condition on talks. The United States is talking to both warring sides in Libya, calling for de-escalation and seeking the appointment of a United Nations chief negotiator, as well as a head of the UN mission in Libya. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy spoke with Wolfgang Putzai, a security analyst at the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations, about these developments.
These efforts from North African countries demonstrate that they are increasingly worried about the situation. The risk of a regional escalation is certainly obvious. I would say there are two key points at the beginning of the way to a political solution. The first one is to overcome the failed Shkirat agreement. It is not evident, it's not clear to me, how this agreement, which has been rejected over the years, could be now accepted in the east or in the south of Libya. And the second key point is to find a formula for a fair distribution of the oil revenues between the three historic provinces and for common needs on the state level. I would say an immediate restart of the oil production and oil exports are required, but all revenues must be deposited on an escrow bank account somewhere abroad or on the current foreign bank account, but under international supervision. The money must remain there until there is an agreement on such a formula, and it could be discussed that there could be an exception to withdraw money to cover the urgent needs of the National Oil Corporation with regard to maintenance and, of course, for fighting the coronavirus.
The U.S. is increasingly worried about the rising Russian influence in Libya. What role you see for the U.S. in this Libyan conflict?
I would say the United States could have a key role in convincing the international backers of both sides. We must not forget that Turkey on one side and Egypt on the other side, as well as the Arabic Emirates, are key allies of the United States in the region. I would say the United States must understand that Turkey is certainly in Libya and also not in Syria, a bulwark against the Russians. They will never ever be able or willing to kick out the Russians of Syria or of Libya. So it's necessary for the United States also to be realistic of what's going on right now, and they should discuss with the respective leaders and convince them to support such a solution, such a ceasefire plan as outlined now by Stephanie Williams.
But we are seeing more diplomatic involvement for the U.S. and Libya with both sides of the war.
Yes, exactly. Just recently, there was an American low-profile delegation in Benghazi discussing with the leadership of the LNA about an eventual ceasefire. And what I've told before about demand of the Libyan National Army that Turkey needs to withdraw entirely from Libya, this is what they've heard in Benghazi. As said, the United States should use the leverage to convince especially the international backers of both sides. Because if Turkey, Egypt and the Emirates support such a peace plan, it will be difficult for the GNA and the HOR, respectively the LNA and the Operation Volcano, to reject such a plan.
But the U.S. still objecting to appoint a new UN envoy in Libya. How do you explain that?
I would say it is quite difficult to find someone who is really suitable for this task. At the beginning, there was a discussion to appoint someone from Algeria, which would, from his profile, certainly be a very good choice. But it is not in the tradition of the United Nations to appoint someone from a neighboring country. So for the time being, as far as I know, there is no real suitable person which was brought up, which could be accepted by everyone. On the other side, the proposal of the United States to appoint not only a head of UNSMIL, but also something like a chief negotiator are not very helpful. We need to be aware that Stephanie Williams' terms as a deputy head of mission and now acting head of UNSMIL ends in October. So it would be certainly useful to have someone as a new head of UNSMIL in the office, let's say in August or at the latest early September.
That was Wolfgang Patsai, a security analyst at the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations, speaking with my colleague, Mohammed Elshenawi. As a pandemic rages and weakens fragile societies, terrorists lie in wait to pounce on vulnerable people, especially on the African continent, a top U.S. military commander says. U.S. military officials say their work on the continent has continued unabated, but that extremists are actively seeking every opportunity to gain a foothold from Senegal to Somalia. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Violent extremist organizations, or VEOs, are seizing on Africa's coronavirus chaos to advance their goals in vulnerable societies, from Nigeria to Mozambique, says the head of U.S. Special Operations Command Africa, Major General Dagvin Anderson. He spoke to reporters via Zoom video conference from AFRICOM headquarters in Stuttgart, Germany.
I do believe the extremists will look to exploit any opportunity they get, and COVID presents those opportunities because COVID stresses any government. We know the governments in these in the nations of Africa are also feeling that stress, and the VEOs will look to exploit that. I can't tell you exactly how, because that will manifest itself in different ways in each of these countries. But these VEOs are very dynamic, and they're very flexible, and they will look to see where those weak points are, or where that can be exploited, and they will go after it.
In West Africa, Islamist extremists have shut down educational systems. Anderson cited more than 3,000 schools shuttered by extremist groups in Mali and Burkina Faso. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, Central African Republic, and Mozambique, they've harnessed local grievances to feed their activities. And he said some of these groups count on foreign assistance from mercenary groups with murky affiliations. The shadowy Wagner group is thought to be active in as many as 20 African countries, including Mozambique, Libya, Sudan, the Ivory Coast, and the Central African Republic. Anderson echoed analysts who believe the Wagner group is closely connected to the Kremlin, a charge the Kremlin has denied.
Russia is directly engaged with them. I see them as being very corrosive. I see them as being detrimental to what should be a common international threat. Unfortunately, what we see is they're fueling the conflict in Libya. to say that that is a private military contractor, I think, is a bit of a stretch, because they're bringing in weapon systems that we saw recently reported in the press that private companies just don't have access to. Those are state-provided weapon systems.
Anderson also touched on the recent announcement that U.S. Africa Command headquarters would move out of Germany to another European nation. He noted that the disruptions of the coronavirus crisis didn't change or diminish U.S. operations in Africa, and reasoned that a change of headquarters would have little effect on their work. What worries him more, he said, is the pandemic's disastrous effect on government services and institutions in Africa. And he noted the military's role is limited and often too late.
We are often the firemen, that if you're calling the firefighters, it means the fire has already broken out, and that we need to do things to do fire prevention, and we need to be able to cut fire breaks to keep that fire from spreading. While I appreciate everyone's interest in what the military brings, if you're ringing the fire alarm, it's probably a little late. We need to do things ahead of it in order to prevent.
Right now, the American general said, families and communities across the world face uncertainty and fear as the coronavirus continues to spread. A military solution alone will not address their needs for food security, schools, decent health care, and basic government services. Some extremist groups say they arose specifically to address those injustices. But, Anderson said, their violent methods are a dead end. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Egypt and Sudan suspended talks with Ethiopia after it proposed linking a deal on its new reservoir and hydroelectric dam to a broader agreement about the Blue Nile waters to replace a colonial-era accord with Britain. The African Union-led talks, among the three key Nile Basin countries, are trying to resolve a years-long dispute over Ethiopia's construction of the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam on the Blue Nile. Ethiopia says the dam will provide electricity to millions of its citizens, but Egypt fears the reservoir will lead to water shortages. The countries have been negotiating over how quickly Ethiopia will fill the reservoir. Agreements dating back to 1929 effectively prevent upstream countries from taking any action, such as building dams and filling reservoirs, that would reduce the share of the Nile's water of downstream countries, Egypt and Sudan. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Here's a recap of our stories. The United Nations Refugee Agency says victims of a suspected Boko Haram terror attack on an IDP camp in Cameroon's far north region remain unprotected and in need of urgent help. Updates on de-escalating the situation in Libya. And Egypt and Sudan suspend talks with Ethiopia on its Blue Nile Dam. Thanks for listening to VOA Africa. And for more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. Gambia's Truth, Reconciliation, and Reparations Commission is suspending public hearings because of the growing number of COVID-19 cases and deaths in the country. From Raleigh, North Carolina, reporter Pautenderi Mbai has been following the story.
Dr. Lamin Cisse is the chairman of the TRRC. He explained the decision.
In the light of the growing seriousness of the COVID-19 situation in the Gambia, the commission has decided to suspend its public hearings till further notice. The suspension will take effect immediately.
The Gambia has a population of close to 3 million people. It has recorded 671 cases of COVID-19 and 14 deaths, and the figures have been spiking. Cisse says public health and safety are important during such emergencies.
At a time when the number of COVID-19 cases in the country is rising at an alarming rate, the Commission is deeply concerned about the safety of both commissioners and the staff of the TRRC, as well as our media partners, our witnesses, our security personnel, and indeed all members of the public.
The TRRC has been mandated to investigate cases of human rights violations perpetrated during dictator Yahya Jammeh's rule. Its work is covering July 1994, when Jammeh toppled the administration of the late Sir Dawda Kairaba Jawara, to 2017.
While the Commission is very keen on completing its work and submitting its final report and recommendations in good time, we are conscious of the fact that continuing our public hearings may put some of the lives of everybody concerned at risk of a COVID-19 infection.
Meanwhile, The commission's secretariat will remain partially open, with some staff coming to the office and some working from home.
During the period of this suspension of public hearings, the various committees of the Commission will continue working on their various agendas. The Commission will also continue working on putting together some aspects of the final report. This work has already started and will continue unabated.
The TRRC's work is supposed to last 2 years. The Commission says it is fully committed to delivering its assigned mandate as soon as possible. For VOA News, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
International health groups warn that COVID-19 is spreading rapidly across Africa and is no longer confined to the big cities. They're concerned that the continent's fragile healthcare systems will be overwhelmed. Officially, South Africa is the worst affected by the pandemic, registering more than 500,000 infections and almost 9,000 deaths. However, new information released today indicates COVID-19 rates are slowing down there. Darren Taylor has more from Johannesburg.
South Africa's health minister, Zweli Mkhize, says there are signs that infections in some provinces have peaked, even though the government's testing more people than ever before.
We have seen now reduced hospital admissions and persons under investigations presenting in health facilities. We have not breached the hospital capacity in all our provinces. Despite the surge, we have not seen a significant increase in the deaths.
Dr. Mkhize points to the Western Cape as an example of some light at the end of a very dark tunnel, as he puts it. During a hard lockdown from the end of March to the end of June, the region accounted for more than two-thirds of all infections.
It was not a province where there was good quarantine and isolation and tracking of conducts in this particular area.
But Mkhize says there's been a steady decline in cases in the Western Cape for the past month.
Even the numbers of deaths that were thought to be expected at that time did not also rise to the level that was expected. However, the province was feeling a lot of pressure. We had opened up a number of field beds and even went to have agreements with the private sector so that they could take some of the patients. But all of that has never really been filled up to capacity.
The province that has really been worrying the health minister and his team is Gauteng. It's the nation's economic heartbeat and home to its biggest city, Johannesburg. In recent times, Gauteng has been recording at least 6,000 new infections every day. This rate, says Mkhize, is now slowly decreasing.
We're not out of the woods yet because those who are managing the hospitalization of patients can still feel that the wards are full and the beds are full. But nevertheless, we've not really gone to a point where we've got no space now for patients.
He says he's cautiously optimistic that the worst of the pandemic may be over for three of South Africa's nine provinces. But Mkhize warns that COVID-19 is still to peak in the second most populous area of KwaZulu-Natal. It's home to 20 million people, and officials there are reporting a lot of new cases every day.
The numbers are very close to the 3,000 mark per day, so it still can take any direction. We are concerned about this, and we believe that this is the area where the real pressure of the COVID is going to be felt, whilst at the same time...
Dr. Mkhize is convinced that the long lockdown and measures such as hand sanitizing have played a big role in waning infection rates. He says the country's greatest challenge now is to sustain such good behavior, to make sure that the models that have forecast up to 50,000 fatalities by November do not come true.
Indications are that the containment measures are beginning to bear fruit, and we may well be over this peak by the end of August. But if we don't insist on distancing and the use of masks, we actually can have a second surge. If we don't continue to contain it, it's going to actually get worse than what we're seeing here. Even the gains.
Mkhize says South Africa and the continent must heed the lessons learned in other parts of the world and not assume that declining infections and deaths mean COVID-19 is under control. It's not, he emphasizes. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
African disaster relief organization Gift of the Givers turns 28 on Thursday of this week. To mark the occasion, the organization is opening a refurbished hospital wing in Mitchell's Plain, South Africa, that's dedicated to treating COVID-19 patients. From Cape Town, reporter Vicky Stark spoke to the Gift of the Givers South African founder, Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman.
Dr. Suleiman rattles off a long list of the various ways his organization is helping to fight the coronavirus pandemic. But he says the biggest challenge is hunger. Suleiman says before the pandemic, the group was fighting a drought in several parts of South Africa. And now with the lockdown cutting off many incomes, thousands are desperate for food.
Parents are sending the kids to dump sites to go and look for food in dump sites. And every time a dump truck comes, the children are excited. There's something to eat from that rotten mess that's coming there.
Suleiman says one of his major criticisms of the government's handling of COVID-19 is that no disaster management plan seems to be in place. He says across the country, Gift of the Givers staff hear the same thing from many people, that promised state-sponsored food parcels and financial assistance have not arrived. He also says in many places, protective equipment for medical staff has also not arrived.
We've been to 180 health facilities. And everywhere we went, the CEOs, the head of the department, the management, nursing staff would come out and they would start dancing, even for a simple thing like a non-contact thermometer. And we would ask, but why are people behaving like this? And they would say, we're waiting for weeks and some places for months, but nothing has been sent to us. Our staff have been infected. We're scared to see the patients. Our family members have died. Colleagues have died. Simply because we don't have protection.
During its almost three decades in existence, Gift of the Givers has made a difference in other countries too.
In 2011, we moved into Somalia and Mogadishu when the famine was killing thousands of children a day. We set up hospitals, we sent in medical teams, we sent in dietitians and food aid, and we've been busy with Somalia ever since. Collectively sending a couple of hundred containers of food aid, you know, over the several years. In 2002, we were involved in the Republic of Congo, where an explosion of ammunition in a residential area killed many civilians. And they were sent in medical teams, search and rescue teams, trauma counselors.
The group also has worked in Malawi, Zimbabwe, Rwanda, and other countries. Suleiman explains how a meeting with a Sufi master in Istanbul, Turkey, led to the birth of the organization.
On the 6th of August, 92, on a Thursday night, after a previous session, the master looked me in the eye, and in fluent Turkish, and I don't speak a word of Turkish, he said to me, my son, I'm not asking you. I'm instructing you to form an organization. The name will be Gift of the Givers. You will serve all people of all races, of all religions, of all colors, of all classes, of all cultures, of any geographical location, and of any political affiliation, but you will serve them unconditionally. You will not expect anything in return.
Suleiman says while many groups struggle for funding at this time of COVID-19, Gift of the Givers regularly gets offers from donors. He says the group hasn't received a cent from the South African government, but South African citizens make substantial contributions. And he says big businesses such as banks, insurance and food companies also have helped.
Microsoft has been doing projects with us for the last 2 years. Ford Foundation has given a substantial amount of money. So, and Walmart gave us close to $7 million from America, and from locally, they give us a lot of things in kind in South Africa.
Since its founding, Gift of the Givers has delivered more than 3 billion South African rand, or nearly 200 million US dollars of aid to 44 countries. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, visit our website at voanews.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans. Brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.